Major funding for On Point is provided by Liberty Mutual for all your auto, home, life, and business insurance needs. Liberty Mutual. Responsibility. What's your policy?
From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Diplomats and generals, Al-Qaeda, the Taliban, and deadly drone pilots are all fighting over Pakistan. Ali Sethi is a 24-year-old Pakistani writer in Lahore, out with his first novel, and he's watching. He's written a story of strong women and a fatherless boy, of virtue and village and city life, of reading the Quran and bootleg movies and booze, a story grounded deep in Pakistan's domestic culture as Pakistan, some days, appears to be falling apart. This hour On Point, life behind the headlines in Pakistan with writer Ali Sethi. You can join the conversation. How will Pakistan come through its trials right now? Is there a clue, a destiny in its culture? You can also comment at our website, onpointradio.org, or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. Joining me now from New York is Ali Sethi. He's a young writer, the son of prominent Pakistani journalists. Grew up in Pakistan, went to college in the United States, currently lives in Lahore, Pakistan. His work has been published in The Nation and The New York Times. His debut novel, out yesterday, is The Wishmaker. Ali Sethi, welcome to the show.
Thank you. Hi.
Hi. Thanks very much for being here. You've got high words of praise for a newcomer, Khalid Hosseini, author of The Kite Runner and A Thousand Splendid Sons. Lots of Americans will have read that. He says that you steadfastly resist the usual cliches about both Islam and your native country. He says you're giving us a nuanced, often humorous, always novel look at life in modern-day Pakistan. You've studied in the U.S., you've grown up and lived in Pakistan. Is it hard to resist the cliches, or do they seem distant when you're sitting in Lahore writing?
You know, there are many cliches. I think there are cliches about and stereotypes about Pakistan outside of Pakistan that I encounter when I am here in the U.S. or in other parts of the Western world, or even if I go to India, you find that people's idea of Pakistan is not always close to the reality of Pakistan. But there are cliches of Pakistan within Pakistan too. I think that's an important distinction to make. There are you know, people in Pakistan who insist that Pakistan has to be a theocratic state, or that it has to be a strictly fundamentalist Islamic society, and there are people who resist those cliches within the country, and that's really what, in some ways, my book is about. The story here is about people who continue to live what are ordinary lives in extraordinary times.
We'll talk about the big picture, what's going on in the headlines. Introduce us to the characters in your book, The Wishmaker. Give us a sense of the cast that you've rolled out for us here. It's a big book.
It is. It's a big book. Well, it's a story about two children, a boy and a girl, who are cousins, but not exactly. They're being raised together in urban middle class Lahore, which is where I'm from. That's in the northwest of Pakistan, close to the Indian border, and they're growing up in the 1990s in a house that is run mostly by women, by the boy's grandmother and his mother, and the boy's father is dead. He used to be a pilot in the Pakistan Air Force and died in a plane crash, and so it's an accident, the absence of that male figure in that house, but it makes for it makes for an interesting domestic situation, because the women have to fend for themselves, and they have to raise these children by themselves in a mostly male dominated society. And there are two servants who work with them for them in the house. One is a woman, Naseem, who's a maid servant and is from the village, a village nearby, but lives with her employers in the city. And the girl, the cousin, Samar, the children's names are Zaki and Samar. And Samar, the girl, is the daughter of Zaki's grandmother's younger sister. And her family is based in a village, which is close to Lahore, which is a city. And even though the distance is not that large between the city and the village, there's the difference in culture, the difference in in the social makeup, the difference in just what is expected of people is often quite stark, and that is what much of the story is about.
We should read just a little bit for us from The Wishmaker. There's a point where Samar has come to the city. Zaki Shirazi is the narrator. These are, as you say, near cousins, best of friends. Set this up for us. But there's a question about that village and Uncle Fazal, her father there, and whether the feudal life in the village, whether he are bad.
Yes, this is the boy, the narrator, Zaki, is asking his mother, who is a liberal, progressive sort of journalist. She likes to think of herself as a liberal, progressive journalist, and she's his widowed mother. And so this is young Zaki talking to his mother about Uncle Fazal, who is the father of Zaki's cousin, Samar Api.
In a way, it's the city asking about the Pakistani village.
That's right. So Zaki says, "Is Uncle Fazal a bad man?" "Not bad," said my mother. "He just follows a very old system. Most of our country is rural. All rural areas are run by feudals. For them, everything is property. Land, labor, women. They have a lot of power. You have to see it to believe it." "Is Uncle Fazal a rich man?" My mother thought about it and said, "He's not that rich. He's got a few hundred acres of land." Dadi, this is the boy's grandmother, laughed and said, "It's more than some other people have." My mother said Dadi was materialistic. "What's that?" I said. "It's when people go after money. It's a historical concept as well. You should read about it when you're older." "Why can't you tell me now?" "I've told you it's when people go after money, when they want money above all else." I said, "What happens in the village?" She said, "Agriculture and exploitation." And I didn't ask her for the meanings of those words. Samar Api's descriptions of life in the village were unimaginable. She said she wasn't allowed to sit with her male cousins. She wasn't allowed to speak until she was spoken to. She wasn't allowed to step out of the house, not even to go into the garden unless she went with a servant. "We have to wear chadars when we go out," she said, "even when we're sitting in the car, and I can't even see through it. And it's so bloody hot in Burhampur, like a bloody oven. There are goats and cows everywhere. Sometimes when our car goes through the street, strange women come out on the balconies and stare at us."
Ali Sethi reading from his new novel, his debut novel, The Wishmaker, about the city boy asking about the rural, feudal village from which his cousin has come. So what about it? When we look at the tensions in Pakistan today, how much of it is moderns versus feudals?
That's a good question. I think much of it can be framed in that way. It is in many ways about the disparities between urban middle class life and the rural life that surrounds and in many ways enables that city life. I think people who live in the big cities, which are Lahore in the northwest and Karachi in the south, which is the big port city, mm-hmm. and now also in many new cities that have come up between those two big cities, people have to work in offices. People watch more TV. They have a more urban existence. There's more information. There's more social interaction between people, which is necessitated by the nature of their work. In the rural areas, you find that life is still lived in ways that are quite old and ancient. I should say here, though, that even the difference between villages in, let's say, the Punjab, which is the province that I come from, mm-hmm. and the villages in the northwest of the country, which is villages that are situated along the border region with Afghanistan, there's a huge difference, because it's almost as though those areas are parts of different histories and different civilizations. I should explain a little bit. You know, when you step out of Lahore, which is my home city, and you drive into the countryside, into the Punjabi countryside, you see women working everywhere. You see them working in the fields. You see them working in factories. You see them everywhere you go. They're a part of the labor. They're a part of social life. You see them everywhere. When you go to the north of Pakistan, to the what we call the federally administered tribal areas, mm-hmm. which have never really been a part of the state, you find that there's not much agriculture. There's not. The life is more is just generally more tribal. Women are treated like property, and women's roles are much more rigidly controlled. They're usually covered from head to toe, wearing burqas. You don't see them. They're not shopkeepers. You don't see them selling fruits and vegetables at the stalls. They're just generally less visible. So in a way there's that kind of diversity within Pakistan, which is, as you know, a huge country. It's a country of 160 million people, and the language changes every 10 or so miles. It becomes a different dialect, and people have different ethnic affiliations and different cultures, and some believe they have different histories.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking about Pakistan this hour through the eyes of young Pakistani writer Ali Sethi. His debut novel just out is The Wish Maker. Makes his home in Lahore, college-educated in the United States. He joins us today from New York City. Ali, let's take a couple of calls right away. People interested in what you're up to. Susanna in Columbia, South Carolina. You're on the air with Ali Sethi.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
My question for Mr. Sethi is this. As a young man, you must have been exposed to a lot of your parents' dinner discussions. You were a son of a journalist. And I was thinking, as a young man, did you kind of always keep these anecdotes in your head about discussions they had? Because I think it's people like you who are going to ultimately change the world. Like, when I had read Husseini's A Thousand Splendid Sons and The Kite Runner, that was an eye-opening experience, because the women want to speak out. They want to get out of their circumstances, but they can't. They're powerless because they're in this structure, this political structure, where they can't speak out, and they want to do the right thing, but they're powerless. And I think I'm assuming, maybe that's the wrong thing to do, I'm assuming you're Muslim, but I think that a lot of Muslims are suffering because they feel like that's not representative of what I believe in. I'm from a religion that teaches peace and love and acceptance and tolerance, and then you have extremists. Like, I was raised Catholic, and, I'm pro-life, but I don't agree with bombing abortion doctors' offices. I mean, I think we all have to come together and say, it's okay not to agree, but we're not going to blow each other up because we don't. You know what I mean?
Susanna, let us pick it up. Ali Sethi, there's a lot there about women, about Islam and peace versus violence. Dive in where you like.
I think those are all important questions. I think it's ultimately a question, I think Susanna was asking about tolerance, basically. And I think that's probably the most important topic in my book and also in my life. I can tell you that, as Susanna has said, there are women have been usually bear the brunt of violence and of just of everything. Whenever something goes wrong in society, or whenever society is experiencing a political change or social change, you find that women tend to become the focus of people's attention. People ask questions about the roles of women in society. And the thing is that, as I say, even within Islam, in Pakistan, there are many different kinds of Islam. There is no one official state state-adopted Islam. And I'm kind of slightly grateful for that, because as long as there is that internal diversity, people can always be aware of what the other version is like. I'll give you an example. I don't know if it qualifies as a brand of Islam, but there's a kind of Sufi Islam, which is the main dominant Islam in Pakistan. This is how Islam came to Pakistan in the Middle Ages and in basically 10th century onward. These mystics, Muslim mystics, who were often poets and musicians, traveled often by foot from Central Asia, from Iran, from the Middle East, and came to what was then the Indian subcontinent. And they learned the local languages, and they basically preached what, as Susanna says, preached tolerance in these local languages. And they wrote poems, and they wrote songs, and they were dancers, and they were mystics. And many of these things, you'd be surprised to know, but many of these poems and these songs are still very much a part of the daily culture and life of Pakistan. Keep in mind that Pakistan is a mostly illiterate country. The literacy rate is extremely low. And in a mostly illiterate country, sometimes the most effective way of reaching people is through oral literature. You know, some of our greatest singers, actually, many of whom were women, have brought to life the poems of some of our greatest poets, not just mystical poets from the 15th century or the 16th century, but also modern contemporary poets. I can give you the example of a poet called Faiz Ahmed Faiz, who, without whom no Pakistani narrative is complete. He's to us what in a way T.S. Eliot is to you here in the U.S. And these poets have been preaching tolerance, and also have been, as Susanna says, they've been trying to change the political structure of society. They have been very politically active, and they have been saying, we need to have reform, we need to have social change, and we need to give everybody room to live. So this is, it's an ongoing process. I must say that I'm disappointed when things don't work out like everybody else is. But I can tell you that I was in Pakistan only 4 weeks ago. And when that, I'm sure you saw it here too. There was a video of this girl being flogged by a Taliban commander in the Swat Valley in Pakistan. And that video, it was made using a cell phone by one of the spectators in that crowd. It surfaced on TV in Pakistan about 2 months ago. And within days of that video surfacing, the professional women of Pakistan, the women who have to go to work, the women who drive their cars, the women who are telephone operators, who use computers, women who are traffic wardens, who are standing on the streets wearing uniforms and holding walkie-talkies, people whose livelihoods depend on social and political freedom, took to the streets. They were demonstrating and they were saying, we do not accept this, we reject this, the Taliban's Islam is blasphemy. So I think there's room for that change, and I sincerely hope that we can improve things.
Resisting that, and of course millions saw that around the world on YouTube, where that video of course showed up. On the other hand, in your book The Wishmaker, very early on, as in real life, you have a mother here, a fictional mother who edits a magazine, Women's Journal, in the book. And right away, she's got a four-page spread. You just sort of casually note, she has a four-page spread in her magazine on the global community of Muslim women who had, in their own ways, quoting you here, resisted the recent American invasion of Iraq. They may be protesting a flogging by the Taliban, but these are sort of presented as magazine-reading middle-class Muslim women in Pakistan, finding their own ways to resist the United States in Iraq.
Sorry, that's right. There's every kind of...
Is that a contradiction, or is it part of the same impulse, or no?
Oh, I don't think it's a contradiction at all. I think it's very much a part of the same impulse, which is one of, you know, I think people who want justice and who want equality. This is the thing. When you see people in Pakistan protesting in these demonstrations, you see that on the one hand they're holding a sign that says no to Taliban, and on the other hand they're also holding, literally in the other hand, they are holding a sign that says no to American drone attacks. Do you know? So it's not actually contradictory. It's just complicated, but it's not contradictory. It's people saying we want to be able to live our lives on the basis of how we want to live them. You know, they're telling the U.S. and they're telling India and they're telling also the Taliban who are in their country, and these Al-Qaeda foreigners, these Arabs and Uzbeks who are sitting in their country and saying, no, you must follow our version of Islam, which is like this. It's these people who are saying, we will not be told by anybody how to live our lives. We want to live our lives. We want to elect our own governments. You know, Pakistan had a spectacular election a year and a half ago in which people voted overwhelmingly for a secular political party, this is the Pakistan People's Party. It has failed most of the time, and it's to deliver, but it always makes the promise of land reform, of increasing employment, of giving jobs to people. So again, it's the economy. And that political party was headed until her death 2 years ago by a woman.
Of course, Benazir Bhutto, yes, there's that impulse. At the same time, your book is haunted in all of its corners by stories about bombings and shootings and killings and guards. The violence is there. And in real life, many serious observers talking about Pakistan being on the brink, I guess, the brink of what? Not something good. Let's get a call from Nashville, Tennessee. Ibrahim, you're on the air with Ali Sethi.
Hi, Tom. I really like your program. I have a question for Ali. Since you're a young intellectual author, and Pakistan has a lot of people like you, older than you. So what I'm saying here is, like, I really don't like Pakistan to be a failed state of 160 million. I come from Somalia with 7 million people only, and that's a failed state now. I wonder how that would look like if Pakistan goes in the same way that we have gone for the past 20 years. And what people like you and order that you have for Pakistan to save this country from failing with all these diverse people. We are one homogeneous group. But I wonder, with the Sindhi, with the Punjabis, with the Pashtun, with the Kashmiris, is there a way you can save this country? And it's going to be bad. And I would like to tell them, the Taliban or people like them or anybody who's a fundamentalist, whatever they represent, that's really not Islam. Islam is a tolerant religion, and Islam is a religion of peace. I just want to tell people that. Whatever they see in videos are really not the typical Islam or what the Muhammad alayhi salatu salam has taught us as Muslims.
It may be, though the images come thick and fast. Ali Sethi, there's a sincere question from a Somali, Ibrahim, saying, all right, you know, his country has fallen apart, Somalia, it's a failed state. What's to keep yours from going the same way? And what do intellectuals like you have to do with the saving, if it's to be saved?
Well, I think I can answer some of that. I appreciate that question, Ibrahim. Thank you for asking it. It's a question that many Pakistanis are asking themselves right now. Are we a failing state? Will we become a failed state? What might that look like, and how can we prevent that from happening? And I can proudly tell you that people, not only people like me, you know, people who've had access to a good Pakistani education and then also to a Western education, people who are privileged enough to, you know, write a book or have their voices heard. There are people who are living in Pakistan, and as I say, whose livelihoods depend on the perpetuation of the society in which they live and the improvement of the society in which they live. These people are students, they are professors, they are activists, they are artists, they are singers, and they are all in some way, in one way or another, resisting the Taliban, Al-Qaeda encroachment, which is, I think, what scares people about Pakistan. You know, I should tell you, we in Pakistan have, in the last 3 years alone, come such a long way. I remember when I was growing up in Pakistan in the 1990s, that may have looked to outsiders like a relatively peaceful time. There were no suicide bombings in Pakistan. The Pakistan did not have any nuclear weapons. And I think that's the two combination, the lack of those two things makes a country look quote-unquote secure to an outsider whose concern is mainly their own security, and understandably. But I can tell you that it was not as free a time in Pakistan as it is right now. This is because there was only one state-run TV channel in Pakistan. And that has changed completely now. There's been a media revolution in Pakistan. There are more than 50 news channels, independent, locally owned and run news channels, which discuss many, many things, not everything, but many things. And there is a lot of political discussion taking place. We have also, because of this media revolution, we have also in Pakistan just recently restored the deposed Chief Justice of Pakistan. So the judiciary has become much stronger and much more independent in the last year, and mostly because of the people's movement, the lawyers' movement. As Mr. Ibrahim asked in his pointed out in his questions, there are intellectuals who live in Pakistan, and these lawyers are practicing intellectuals. Like I say, their livelihoods depend on the improvement of society. Their livelihood depends on keeping alive what they call the liberal constitutional spirit of the founding fathers of Pakistan. So there are people like them, and they are participating in this change that is taking, in this national consensus that is growing in Pakistan right now against Talibanization.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking with debut novelist Ali Sethi. Let's get a call from Khalil in Wellesley, Massachusetts. Khalil, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom. How are you?
Very well, thanks.
Ali, that's very good to hear that a young Pakistani writing a book, you know, on this topic, which is pretty, you know, hot on the news these days. My question for you, Ali, is that when we talk about urban areas, you know, where people live in a different lifestyle than the rural areas, How do you see the diversity? Is it more like a strength of different cultures, of different languages coming together, you know, bonded by one, let's say, common religion? Or would it be more as a weakness, because that when we talk about the country failing, to me it seems like we are looking at more as a weakness, and we cannot be all homogenized. You know, that's not how we are made. So I wanted to hear your sort of comment on this.
Thank you, Khalil. Ali Sethi?
That's a great question. Actually, I agree with Khalil that diversity, or what looks like a wide spectrum within society, is not always a good thing, because the differences, while they can be cultural and while they can be linguistic differences or ethnic differences, are often refracted by socioeconomic differences, differences of class, differences of political allegiance, because of that combination of class, ethnicity, culture. The thing is, I would like to point out that Pakistan, which was created only 62 years ago, the original vision of Pakistan that Mr. Jinnah, who was the founder of Pakistan and who was a lawyer, had was one of a country in which regions would have a lot of autonomy, and that really is the key to holding such a diverse country like Pakistan together. I think I would point out that India, which is our neighbor, they've been more successful. I think everybody would agree with me. They've been more successful at holding their diversity together, and part of the reason for that is that they have allowed democracy in the true sense to continue on its course. That means greater representation for more people.
But your autonomy, it also seems at risk of tearing the country apart. I mean, you've got people coming out, of the Swat Valley now, 50 miles from Lahore, and threatening to take right over, from the territories that have been very, very lightly governed by from the center.
Well, I think this is the thing, is that I think that this is, there's a cause and effect relationship here that has to be put into perspective. This is happening right now precisely because military dictators who ruled Pakistan for more than half its history have ignored people's local demands and needs, and have in fact tried to import from the Middle East, from the Arab Middle East, a kind of fundamentalist Islam that is completely alien to us, and they have done this for political reasons. The 1980s, I think every Pakistani has to grapple with what happened in Pakistan in the 1980s, because I think that was in some ways the darkest decade in Pakistan's history. We were ruled for 11 years by a military dictator called General Zia, who deposed a democratically elected prime minister and hanged him, and exiled all political leaders, exiled our poets, silenced opposition, silenced the press, and set up these madrasas and set up these militant camps all over the Afghanistan-Pakistan border. So this, what we're seeing right now, is in a way the ripening of that.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking today about Pakistan through the eyes of a young Pakistani writer, Ali Sethi. His debut novel just out is The Wish Maker. U.S. educated, university educated, lives now in Lahore, Pakistan. Son of very prominent journalist parents in that country. Ali, you earlier mentioned the drone attacks in Pakistan along the border, mainly with Afghanistan there. Of course, these are U.S. drones piloted out of pilots thousands of miles away in the United States. There's been an increasing number. The U.S. has expressed some kind of great satisfaction with their effectiveness in going after the leadership of Al-Qaeda and Taliban there. You seem sort of appalled by the drone attacks. At the same time, you've expressed great discomfort with the Al-Qaeda in Pakistan. If you don't like the Al-Qaeda in Pakistan, why don't you like the drones that may be chasing them out?
I don't like the drones because the drones, I don't think they have been very effective. I have been reading about them a lot, and I know people who have experienced them firsthand and have seen the kinds of things that they do. I don't have the exact statistic with me right now, but this is a figure that has been quoted again and again in the U.S. press here and much more frequently in Pakistan. The ratio of terrorist to civilian casualty in terms of what the drone is able to achieve, quote unquote, is sort of something like they've been able to kill about a little more than a dozen Al-Qaeda leaders with these mm-hmm. with these drones so far, and within those same attacks they've killed about 600 people. For 16 Al-Qaeda leaders or for 16 wanted terrorists to kill 600 civilians who have nothing to do with it or who are innocent and helpless, that is the kind of thing that leads to mass outrage and mass confusion in a place like Pakistan. The first thing people say is, well, why is another country violating our sovereignty? You know, freedom is a word that is used a lot again and again here in the U.S. about American culture, but also about what America wants to show to the rest of the world and share with the rest of the world. I think what's happening right now in Pakistan, the Pakistan military has finally cracked down on the very militants that it has been nurturing and protecting for a long time. This is, I think, in a way, a more acceptable to the Pakistani people. This is a more acceptable response to the Taliban problem, even though it has displaced, as you say, 3.5 million people now. But if the Pakistan government had not signed the peace deal with the Taliban 3 months ago, I don't think we would have gotten here right now. So I think as long as they don't mess it up right now, I think as long as we are able to continue to have this consensus against the Taliban within Pakistan, a domestic, organic, homegrown consensus, which says we do not want to be a theocracy, we want to be a democratic representative republic. I think that's the key to improvement, and that will ultimately also solve this militancy problem.
Has it taken Pakistan too long to reach that consensus? You know, some would say that there were many years here where the Taliban influence there was growing and growing, and very little was being done. You may not like the drones, but I've heard it said just in recent days that Lahore waited way too long to respond.
That's absolutely right. I think the world has been and Pakistan's rulers have really messed it up. I want to point out here that the Mujahideen, the people who have been carrying out the so-called jihad in the name of Islam, were created in the 1980s by the Pakistan military with a lot of funding from the United States of America. Your U.S. Secretary of State Hillary Clinton has just gone on record and made this big statement where she said, we created these people, and now these people who were once our friends because they were fighting the communists in Afghanistan, now they're tearing a place like Pakistan apart. So I think it's a collaboration between all interested parties, the United States, Saudi Arabia, the military in Pakistan, miscalculations and mistakes. And this is what is the result of it. And I think that the Pakistani people really, because they have had really not had a say. Democracy has been blocked out of Pakistan for so long by generals, and generals who've been kept alive by so much foreign funding, the Pakistani people are really not to blame for this.
You're in New York. There's a headline in the New York Times today, page one, saying that some in Al-Qaeda leave Pakistan for Somalia and Yemen. It is Al-Qaeda leaders reportedly leaving Pakistan, moving to set up operations in Somalia and Yemen. When you read that, do you imagine that Al-Qaeda, some leaders may be leaving Pakistan because they've been run out of Pakistan, pressured out, or because they have the country, together with the Taliban, have it sewn up? They've won and they're moving on.
I don't think they've won. There's another report in the New York Times today, actually, just below that report. A very prominent cleric called Maulana Sarfaraz Naimi has been killed today in a suicide bomb attack. This man was a religious scholar and a moderate, and a man who has been attacking the Taliban in all his speeches for about a year now and saying, this is not Islam, this is barbarism. This is, the kind of thing that our listeners right now have been saying, the questioners, the people who've called in with questions, Mr. Ibrahim and Susanna before him, both of whom said Islam is a religion of peace. So as I say, when a Pakistani says this in Pakistan, it becomes a political statement. It's no longer just a cultural statement or an assessment. It becomes a political act. You are threatening the Taliban and taking them on. So, the fact that a cleric has now been killed, the fact that this fight has now entered, people from one madrasa are now bombing people in another madrasa. in Pakistan means clearly that there is a fight going on for the soul of Pakistan. This has become now an existential crisis. People in Pakistan everywhere, whether they are clerics or journalists or lawyers, are asking themselves, what kind of country do we want to live in? And I think unanimously people of Pakistan have said, we do not want Al-Qaeda in this country. Whether you look at the election results, in which people have just not voted for the religious parties, or you look at the growing consensus in the Pakistani media, in the Pakistani press, on the Pakistani streets against Al-Qaeda.
An existential conflict within Pakistan, do you see it as an insurrection, a civil war, an infiltration? How do you
do
look
I
at
see
it?
You
describe it as an existential conflict for the sort of soul and future of the country. Is that a civil war?
Well, it's not yet a civil war, and I hope it doesn't become a civil war, but we have had a civil war before in Pakistan, which led to the creation of Bangladesh in East Pakistan mm-hmm. in 1971. You know, civil war, this is not new to Pakistan, and that's extremely unfortunate. But what I'm trying to say is that along with, you see, the violence is the face of it, but behind the violence, there is growing debate and discussion in a society that for too long has not had any debate and discussion about what kind of country it wants to be. Mm. And that is also a positive change. I see it absolutely as a positive change. The fact that people everywhere are saying, well, this is the kind of country we want. And that answer is increasingly an answer that resists the Taliban and resists Al-Qaeda. What I'm saying is that mm-hmm. I don't think there is any chance that Pakistan can be or will be ruled by Al-Qaeda or the Taliban or those extremists. They are creating havoc because they've been armed for too long. They have too many weapons, and they've been allowed to exist in our territories for too long. But nobody is voting for them. Nobody is accepting them. Nobody is working with them. I think these are good things.
Somebody's working with them, I have to point out. I mean, there are a lot of people carrying guns.
As I say, you know, Tom, many of those people are refugees. Many of those people are people who are not, they're foreigners to Pakistani. The people who've been commanding these terrorist attacks, many of them are Uzbeks, they are Tajiks, they are Arabs, some of them are Somalis. They are sitting in that lawless, borderless region between Afghanistan and Pakistan, and they are leading the attacks from there. Almost every intelligence report that comes in about an attack that takes place in Lahore or Karachi or elsewhere, you find that these people have cells in these cities, but the headquarters of Al-Qaeda is in that borderless area between Afghanistan and Pakistan. And I think that's part of the reason that this report has come in today, and as you pointed out in the New York Times, which says that Al-Qaeda leaders are leaving Pakistan. I suspect that that has something to do with this ongoing military operation against them.
Let's get a call from Nazreen in Arlington, Massachusetts. Nazreen, you're on the air.
Hello, Nazreen.
Nazreen, hi, thank you.
Hi, thank you for taking my call. And I like your show, and congratulations, Ali. I'm very impressed. I didn't read your book yet, but so far your comments were very on the top of the line. I think any discussion about the internal conflicts in Pakistan will not be complete if we don't talk about the historic role of India. So I read two books, The Last Mughal, and the other one is The Company which Changed the World. Both of them are written by British authors. And reading those books for the first time, the thought came to my mind that during the Liberation War, during the participation, Pakistan had to give up many important resources like New Delhi, Taj Mahal, which are eternal source of not only foreign currency and also pride of the Mughal Empire. They had to give up those to India and vast resources. On top of that, Kashmir had been a source of conflict. So I would like to know your opinions on those.
Thank you very much, Nazreen. Ali Sethi, what about it? That conflict, the sort of original conflict in Pakistan's national life, has been so prominent for so long. Do you still see it behind Pakistan's problems today? Are you moving past the India-Pakistan conflict, or is that impossible?
Well, I don't think it's impossible. I hope that it happens soon. But I think I agree with you with what you're suggesting, which is that that is very much a part of our national crisis and has been for a long time. I want to point out again, please, that democratic leaders in Pakistan, people who have been democratically elected by the people, whenever that has been allowed to happen, have again and again tried to start the peace process. And they have been sabotaged again and again by the Pakistan military, which has been historically the most powerful institution in Pakistan, because the military has not until very recently wanted peace with India, because if there is peace with India, then, you know, why should so much of our national budget go towards what is called defense? Why should all of our money be spent on more armament and more jets and more weapons for soldiers, and less on education and less on healthcare? So I think with growing peace, there will be growing democracy and vice versa. I think one thing supports the other, and it's a healthy symbiotic relationship. I really hope there is peace with India.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. Let's get a call from Sushil in Brookline, Massachusetts. Sushil, you're on the air.
I have a question for Ali.
Yes, please.
I am from India, and I want to know from you whether democracy can really be established in Pakistan with the background that you have, a whole lot of the politicians you've had, a few, they've all been corrupt, they've proved to be ineffective, and the army always finds an excuse for coming in to take over. In this situation, do you think democracy will be able to get established in Pakistan? Even today, you have a semblance of a democratic government, but the army is looming large in the background.
That's absolutely right. The army is looming large in the background, and that is unfortunate and regrettable, and you know, makes many of us angry. That's a good question. The question is, can democracy really be established in Pakistan? Look, I'd just like to say, democracy is not just, as Sushil has pointed out very accurately, democracy is not just having an election and then having somebody who's vaguely elected through a defunct and old and crumbling political process sit be your head of state. Democracy is more than that. Democracy is representation. Democracy is accountability. Democracy is checks and balances. And like I said, having a freer media, having a freer and more independent judiciary, having a vibrant civil society, having students who protest every time something that in their life goes wrong or is amiss, all of these things will contribute to a more democratic society. It'll become more and more difficult for a military dictator to take over and silence the people when there are all these checks and balances in society. You know, President Musharraf, General Musharraf, retired, I should say, who took power in 1999 in a bloodless coup and dismissed an increasingly unpopular but democratically elected government, was welcomed when he took over because the economy was crashing. The then democratically elected prime minister, as is shown in much of actually my story as well, was attacking journalists, including my parents. My father was arrested in 1999 for allegedly making an anti-state speech in India, which was hostile territory. The real reason was that my father was working on a documentary about the corruption of the then government. So this is extremely unfortunate that democratically elected leaders in Pakistan's history have tended to be autocratic and have in a way sabotaged the very process that has brought them to power. But like I say, the anti-Musharraf movement, the anti-military movement that began 3 years ago and that led to the reinstatement of our Chief Justice, that led to the reopening of the banned TV channels, and that led ultimately to the resignation of General Musharraf, has strengthened Pakistani society. It really has. It might not look like that right now, but I have hope in this civil society that has been born in the last 3 years.
Do your parents share that hope? I mean, they've seen so many years and years in which you may be pro-democracy, but so much of Pakistani history has leaned against it. You're 24. They're, I don't know, older. They've seen a lot. Do they remain optimistic? I mean, are there times when you despair and say, oh, look at this history, there's something we just can't get over here?
There are absolutely times when I despair. In fact, I should tell you, you know, after when I guess when you're growing up and when you're a child, you don't, even when you know, your country is experiencing some kind of national turmoil and trauma, because you're a child, you tend to fixate on all kinds of random and odd things. When I went back to Pakistan after attending college here in the U.S., mm-hmm. This is now a post-9/11 environment, mm-hmm. A world which was, as we know, drastically changed by the increasing suicide bombings and attacks and increasing violence in Pakistan. I was depressed. And I know that many of my friends who were living in Pakistan and who had gone to college in Pakistan and not abroad were even more depressed because it affected their daily lives. But like I say, there are people who continue to live there. You know, life does go on, believe it or not. There are people who still have jobs. There are people who still have families. And these people have to protect their lives and they have to protect their families. And to do that now, these people feel that they have to be politically engaged. And my parents are among those people. I can you know, personally tell you that many of my friends who were completely apolitical growing up, like most kids are everywhere, they were concerned with, you know, the regular teenage issues. You know, they wanted to listen to good music. They wanted to go to parties. They wanted to have fun, and they wanted to rebel against their parents. Are finding that the only way that they can really exist in a place like Pakistan right now is by voicing their opinions about what they think needs to improve in society. So that's a good thing.
Ali Sethi of Lahore with us today from New York, out with his debut novel, The Wishmaker. Ali Sethi, thank you very much for your work and for your time today. It's been great to have you. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you, Tom.
A lot of women in this book. Behind me right here, Jawad Ahmad singing Mendi, a song from a 2004 CD celebrating the tradition of painting the body with henna before wedding ceremonies. A diverse culture. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. Thanks for joining us.